From Chicago Public Radio, I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and this is Odyssey. The United States has withdrawn its support for the International Criminal Court. International law has always raised difficult questions of jurisdiction and state sovereignty. Is the U.S. guarding its national interests, or do American objections reflect larger disagreements about the goals of international criminal justice? Coming up on Odyssey, we'll examine the U.S. position and the complexities of international criminal law. That's Odyssey, right after this. From Chicago Public Radio, this is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. The United States is pulling out of the treaty establishing an international criminal court. Former President Clinton signed the treaty in December of 2000, but didn't submit it for ratification by the Senate. Now, the Bush administration has announced that it will not support the treaty. It has, in effect, unsigned the agreement and plans to limit its cooperation with the International Tribunal. Creation of the court will proceed anyway. The requisite number of countries have ratified the treaty, but U.S. participation would likely have made a significant difference in how the new court develops. Today on Odyssey, we're going to explore the movement toward an international criminal court and look at whether U.S. objections stem from parochialism or from a broader disagreement about the appropriate nature of an international justice system. Joining us are Ruth Wedgwood, who is a law professor at Yale University and Johns Hopkins. She joins us from New York City. Joining us from Durham, North Carolina, is Duke Law Professor Madeline Morris. And here in Chicago, we're talking with Bartram Brown, who is a professor at Chicago Kent College of Law. Bart Brown, let me ask you to begin. Tell us what this court will do.
Well, during the 1990s, we had some terrible situations like those in the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, where there were crimes against humanity, genocide. And ad hoc tribunals were created to deal with it, Yugoslavia Tribunal, Rwanda Tribunal. The ICC, International Criminal Court, is basically creating a permanent institution to deal with future situations of that kind, so we won't have to take an ad hoc approach to dealing with them.
And when does this court get up and running?
Well, it will officially come into existence this summer, July 1st, since the treaty has now received the ratification of 60 countries. But it'll be a while before it's really up and running.
Madeline Morris, the court itself is new, but the crimes that it will have jurisdiction over are crimes that have been recognized as violations of international law for some time. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's been law of war for centuries and centuries. It would be hard, to go back and say this is the time that the idea of legal constraints on the means of warfare first began. But prior to the tribunals at Nuremberg and Tokyo after World War II, there were not international tribunals actually holding people individually criminally accountable for the crimes in question.
What sort of sanction was there before Nuremberg or Tokyo?
Well, if the perpetrator were captured by an enemy force, that other country might prosecute the individual, or it might well be that if the individual's own country didn't approve of the crimes, that is, if they were not part of that country's policy, then the person might even be prosecuted for war crimes by their own state.
Ruth Wedgwood, can you talk a little bit about the process by which a case or an individual might end up before this new court?
Well, that's one of the sources of potential controversy. Situations could be referred to the court or matters taken up by the court by any of three means. One is the way that was used in the ad hoc tribunals for Rwanda and Yugoslavia, and that's by a referral from this UN Security Council, on which there are 5 permanent members and 10 temporary members, the 5 permanent US, UK, France, China, and Russia, each of whom have a veto. The second way is by a complaint filed by a state party, a state that's joined the so-called Rome Treaty. And the third is by the prosecutor's own decision of something that he or she thinks is potentially actionable.
A prosecutor working for the court?
Well, prosecutor chosen by the Assembly of States Parties and working for the court's apparatus, yes. And independent in the sense only that it's not, he's not or she's not beholden to the UN Security Council, but there will be inevitably a politics within the court itself.
Let me ask you another question about that prosecutorial role. How are these prosecutors appointed, and who do they, in a sense, represent?
Well, the stated point of the International Criminal Court was to have an independent voice, so that once there's a selection of the prosecutor by the Assembly of States Parties, in theory, that person will be independent. There will have to be approval of various steps and charging decisions by chambers of the pretrial court set up also by this same treaty apparatus. But I think what's going to be interesting, and I'm sure we'll get into this, is that the premise that you can do any of these things wholly independently from foreign politics, from the problems of peaceful democratic transitions, is going to be difficult to reconcile with this stated independence of the prosecutor.
We're talking today about the new International Criminal Court and U.S. objections to it. Bart Brown, let me ask you about this prosecutor question, because I'm wondering, in a domestic legal context, prosecutor represents the people or the state or the lawmakers. Is there a clear sense in this case that the prosecutors are representing the state's party to the treaty or the international community or some acknowledged group of people?
Well, the prosecutor will be acting on behalf of the international community, but will be selected by the state's party to the statute. So he will be chosen by them and accountable to them. So I suppose that would be where we would see the accountability factor. And I know there's a lot of concern that this prosecutor might be some kind of rogue international Kenneth Starr, but I just... One important distinction is the judges that appointed Kenneth Starr didn't have to worry about whether he would investigate them. He was only appointed to investigate President Clinton, whereas the prosecutor of the ICC will be chosen by states, any one of which might potentially be a target of investigation and prosecution. So I think that reduces considerably the likelihood that he's going to be some kind of rogue prosecutor running amok.
Well, why not? Why make the tribunal permanent? Why weren't ad hoc tribunals a good enough solution? When you have an instance of war crimes, why not just come up with a tribunal then, try the people involved, and be done with it?
Sure. Well, I mean, the problem is that if we're talking about an institution of international justice, there's supposed to be equal justice, and this idea that you create a tribunal for Rwanda but not for Cambodia, for example, just seemed hard to justify in terms of principle. And again, what's been created is not something that's going to try, every case and get involved everywhere. It's just a sort of fail-safe institution in case no one else, no state, is able to investigate or prosecute.
Ruth Wedgwood, what are the U.S. objections to the treaty? Why did the Bush administration, or what do you understand to be the reasons that the Bush administration has taken the position that it's taken?
Well, there are a couple of different things. First of all, I think the U.S. feels peculiarly vulnerable, because we have 220,000 lads and lasses deployed overseas in the armed forces, and no other country has that number of personnel, even approaching that number of personnel abroad. So when our young kids are either on duty or doing R&R in the middle of their duty, I think there's a concern that they could be made the plaything of political differences. Secondly, there really is a good deal of indeterminacy in the law of war. We're used to the clear cases, Rwanda and some of the worst events of Bosnia and Croatia, what I might call massacre law, where there's no doubt that a crime has been committed. But there are lots of other areas in applying the idea of protecting civilian targets or in deciding what's undue harm to civilians, I should say civilian objects, not targets, where there are good faith differences among NATO countries, certainly between NATO countries and other countries, on what is appropriate use of air power. And I'll just give you one example. In the Kosovo air campaign, the very first thing that we do when we're entering an area of operations is to establish air superiority. To do that, we need to take out the anti-aircraft systems. And to do that, we typically have to at least disable the electrical grids. And there are critics who think that that kind of target, because it's also used in civilian functions as well. Electricity is a ubiquitously useful commodity. That is an illicit target. We would argue that it's a military target. Others would say it's dual use, dual civilian, and therefore illegal. My concern is that good faith differences would be escalated into crimes.
What about not so good faith differences, Madeline Morris? I mean, it seems like the way that Ruth Wedgwood has characterized U.S. objection leaves open one possibility, which is that U.S. forces abroad, while they might be subject to political prosecution, might actually also commit war crimes, whether, you know, out of for a variety of reasons. I don't mean to suggest that these things just happen, but it's obvious that these lines are not necessarily clear and not necessarily easy to maintain in the heat of combat. And I'm wondering to what extent that concern, that the U.S. will be hauled into court because U.S. soldiers actually broke the law.
Well, the question is, who should be prosecuting U.S. or any other soldiers that break the law? Presumably, the United States will prosecute any particular individual who clearly and blatantly violated the law of war. In fact, the International Criminal Court Treaty itself provides that states will have first crack at prosecutions, that the ICC will only be permitted to conduct prosecutions if states are unable or unwilling to conduct those prosecutions. So it certainly is not the case that in the absence of the ICC, blatant war crimes would have no place to be prosecuted. Now, which brings us back to the question of the more ambiguous cases, the areas where the law may be open or unsettled or controversial. And there the question really is, who gets to decide, who gets to make the law in this field? And I think that one of the major components of the U.S. objection to the court, and certainly an objection that I think more states share, has to do with a democratic shortcoming where you have a court making law in these close cases or in these controversial areas, a court deciding what the law is or should be, without the participation of states that have chosen not to become parties to the treaty. So this is a major issue as well.
Wait, you mean so states who are not party to the treaty would be subject to the court even though they have not been involved in the process of making the law?
According to the treaty. Now, that doesn't mean that it will be so in fact, and certainly the U.S. has said that it would not submit or allow its citizens to be submitted to the jurisdiction of the court. But the treaty says that this court will have jurisdiction over, will have the power to prosecute any individual from any country in the world, regardless of whether or not that person's own country has become a party to the treaty, has consented to that power. According to the treaty itself, that wouldn't make any difference. The court would have jurisdiction to prosecute if the alleged crimes were committed on the territory of a country that is a party to the treaty. So this is the fundamental objection on the U.S. side. This objection was stated in a declaration that accompanied President Clinton's own signature of the treaty. Upon signing, he also submitted a paragraph saying, we have serious objections to the treaty, particularly this idea about jurisdiction over individuals who are from states that are not parties to the treaty. And because of these objections, unless and until they are addressed adequately, the U.S. will not, this president will not send this treaty to the Senate for ratification and would recommend that subsequent presidents do not do so either.
Bart Brown, one quick question. Is there an important distinction in the Bush decision to withdraw from the treaty rather than just not address the issue of ratification now?
Well, basically, the Bush administration has chosen to make as explicit as possible its contempt for the treaty, and so I don't think the practical effect is very great.
All right, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the International Criminal Court, the U.S. response to it, its announced withdrawal from the treaty, and some of the larger objections and issues that still exist in the move towards the creation of an international legal regime. We'll also take some calls a bit later in the program. Stay with us. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you are listening to Odyssey. You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and on today's program, we're talking about the establishment of an international criminal court, the U.S. decision not to participate, and what that objection means. We're joined by Bartram Brown, who co-directs the program on international and comparative law at Chicago Kent College of Law. He served as a legal advisor to the Republic of Trinidad and Tobago at the Rome Diplomatic Conference on the Establishment of an International Criminal Court. Joining us today from Durham, North Carolina, is Madeline Morris. She researches and writes on international criminal justice issues and teaches in the law school at Duke University in Durham. We're also joined from New York City by Ruth Wedgwood, who is a law professor at Yale University and Johns Hopkins. She's also a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Ruth Wedgwood, looking at the U.S. objection in the context of all of the controversies that have or issues that have surrounded this treaty, are the U.S. objections parochial, or do they reflect larger concerns, shared concerns, about what it would mean to establish an international justice system?
Well, I don't think they're parochial. I think it took a while for folks to realize that these problems were underlying the whole enterprise and that they would be fundamental deal breakers. I disagree with Bart, I have to say, with love and respect, in his use of the word contempt, because I do think that, in fact, the Bush unsigning, so-called, was done with a very soft landing, which I can get into. But this is not a question of paranoia or parochialism. Rather, I think it comes to a concern that other states may not share our view of the necessary role of force, I mean, legitimate lawful force, in the maintenance of a world security system. And as well, that in this kind of a court, the other countries may have the, I think, very mistaken view that that treaty texts and pieces of paper are self-enforcing and may not understand that, in fact, to make a court like this work, you not only need decent restraints on its exercise of power, but you need as well countries that are willing to give it muscle diplomatically, economically, and even militarily.
Do you think, Ruth Wedgwood, that the United States is in a different position with respect to this court than other countries by virtue of the fact that it has so many soldiers deployed abroad, that it is either more vulnerable or at the very least just in a different relationship to these issues than other less involved countries are?
Well, certainly the asymmetry in military power, which, to be honest, is an aftermath of World War II, because Germany and Japan, who were the other two great economies that could support large military establishments, are both historically disabled from taking what would otherwise be their logical regional roles. Only the U.S. really has, if you'd like, a piece of every pie in the deterrence that maintains security in the Pacific and East Asia and in Europe and in the Middle East. Certain kinds of harder, nastier tasks sometimes fall to us, whether it's deterring the North Koreans from coming south on the Korean Peninsula or doing certain things in counterterrorism. We are Israel's most stalwart friend. There's been a funny allocation of task almost in which the Europeans are content to pursue a human security agenda and use that in part to bulk up their European identity as being largely a moral identity. And I think that therefore feel very judgmental toward the U.S. when the very tasks they're content to leave to us in terms of investment and capability are then seen to often deal in rather close and difficult moral questions.
Madeline Morris, do you think that the problems that Ruth Wedgwood has alluded to, the problems of different understandings about the lawful use of force, could they be eliminated either in definition or in practice and custom?
Well, perhaps over time, but that time hasn't come. The issues arise and re-arise, and they get negotiated out through political processes as well as judicial decisions over a long period of time. I don't think that it would be possible to sort of concretize the issues sufficiently and then negotiate them in some new treaty so that suddenly the law of this enormous area would become clear and there'd be no more indeterminacy in the law. And in fact, that brings us back to the question of how should this body of law be made and concretized and defined and redefined over time, and who should have the opportunity to make those decisions. So when you ask Ruth Wedgwood, is, you know, are these concerns parochial, or do they go to broader underlying questions? In my view, they go to the fundamental question, which is how will the international system, the system of international relations, the system of international law, be structured in the future? Will it be structured in a way that is consistent with our values of democratic governance, where people are represented in and through their own governments in an international system based on the consent and participation of states? Or are we going to go off into a direction in which there are independent international entities that are doing lawmaking that's in a way divorced from the populations over whom they would exercise authority? You know, this has been a big issue relative to the World Trade Organization, other international organizations, but for reasons that we can get into if we want, nobody has spotted this as an issue that is, or at least there hasn't been enough clarity about this democratic deficit as it relates to the International Criminal Court, where, in my opinion, it's actually more pointed than even relative to the WTO or other international institutions where it's been a kind of cause célèbre.
Bart Brown?
Well, the United States government, representing the people of the United States, participated in negotiating this treaty, probably is responsible for more of the text of the treaty than any other state. I mean, it's not even close, by a factor of probably 4 or 5. So the text of the treaty already incorporates a lot of the principal concerns of the United States. Even beyond that, the elements of the crimes, which further narrow the definitions and narrow the applicability of the treaty, were practically written by the United States, I think a lot of it at the Pentagon. So a lot of these U.S. concerns we hear about, these democratic concerns, have already been addressed. We've gotten everything except one thing, and that is an absolute veto over prosecutions. And so it seems to me that's the real issue here, is whether the U.S. has to retain an absolute veto of prosecutions or not. And indeed, the treaty doesn't provide for that, but it has addressed other concerns of the United States that have been raised by the other speakers here.
Could I respond to that just a
Sure.
A second? If you look at the text of the treaty, it talks about having judges who have backgrounds in international law and judges who have backgrounds in criminal law. They could be practitioners or law professors or judges from their own countries. It doesn't talk about anybody with a background in military affairs. And when you're dealing with a concept like proportionality, is there a way to do it that's equally efficient but spares more civilian lives? That requires knowledge of the alternatives. It requires a kind of battlefield second sense, a Fingerspitzgefühl, a kind of a tradecraft knowledge of what's practicable. And the idea of taking a basic Yale law professor or a Duke law professor or a Kent law professor and making him the judge of that with no background in the area, I can see why, I think perhaps many people could see why, that causes some dyspepsia to military operators who have to run their air campaigns. I mean, it's tough enough running an air campaign in the back and forth of the NATO alliance, picking targets and vetoing targets, but to then suppose that you have to get the court involved. I mean, to be safe, you'd have to have an advisory opinion from the ICC saying that this particular target choice is legal.
And you're saying that the way the judges would be selected, they really wouldn't be competent to make those judgments about, making military actions, which military actions would conform to rules of proportionality and discrimination.
Well, what one Dutch lawyer I talked to recently said, well, you know, judges do all sorts of things. They do commercial adjudications in the diamond trade, and they do who stole your horse. But this stuff is different, and it's something I think that the divorce between civil culture and military culture in our own country post-Vietnam has contributed to, in the sense of a lack of appreciation, even among foreign policy experts so often, as to what the military really can and cannot do. And I do think at Rome that, in retrospect, perhaps everyone would realize that there was no thought given to the necessary role of military expertise in forming these judgments.
Ruth Wedgwood teaches in the law school at Yale University and Johns Hopkins University. She's also a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And she joins us today from New York City. We're talking about the International Criminal Court and U.S. objections to it. We'll take some calls a bit later in the program. Our number is 888-859-1800. 1-888-859-1800. Give us a call if you'd like to join in the conversation. We're also talking with Bartram Brown from Chicago Kent College of Law, where he co-directs the program on international and comparative law. And joining us from Durham, North Carolina, is Madeline Morris, who teaches in the law school at Duke University and researches and writes on international criminal justice issues. Madeline Morris, did you want to comment on the issues we were just discussing?
Yeah, I did. I wanted to pick back up on Bart Brown's point about the U.S. participating in negotiation of the ICC treaty, and doesn't this respond to the democratic representation problem that I was raising? And he's absolutely right. Of course, the U.S. did participate in negotiating the treaty in a very engaged and in-depth way, and though there was interagency conflict within the U.S. government about what should happen, which probably reduced the effectiveness of some of our input, nevertheless, the U.S., I think, contributed very meaningfully in the treaty negotiation. That doesn't mean that the democratic problem is addressed, not at all. In fact, that's just the beginning of the story. The question is, when a state participates in good faith in a treaty negotiation, and then at the end of the negotiation concludes that, notwithstanding the excellent give and take, we cannot sign on to this treaty. We just haven't been able to get there. We haven't been able to resolve our concerns. Then does that state have the right or not to withhold its consent? Or instead, are we entering into a system of international law in which you do your best to negotiate a treaty, but if you don't succeed in negotiating a treaty that your state can live with, you're nevertheless somehow required to sign on, participate in some way, subject your nationals to the jurisdiction of, in this case, a court, and be told after the fact, look, we let you participate in negotiation, that's all you get. I don't think so. I think that we have to maintain not only our interest in the human rights that the court would defend, the human right to freedom from genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, but also the human right to democratic governance, to live in a system in which there is no governmental authority that can be exercised relative to a particular population without that population having some basis in the consent of the governed and the continuing representation of the governed, so that when you have a court that's going to be making law, and you know the court's jurisdiction is intended to grow, specifically the areas of terrorism, drug crimes, and other areas, the crime of aggression, all are contemplated within the constituting documents of the court as areas that the court will have power over. The question is, with what representation by those people over whom the court would exercise that power?
Madeline
so
Morris,
the story is much longer.
Okay, let me ask you to clarify something. Mm-hmm. Is your the democracy deficit, do you see it in the procedures that produced the treaty and the mechanisms of ratification, or in the fact that the treaty itself presumes to have jurisdiction over nationals of non-states party?
Yes, it's the latter. The problem has to do with the purported authority of the court to prosecute and punish nationals of states that have never agreed to participate in this treaty. So relative to the citizens of states that have become parties to the treaty, there's no problem. Their states have consented on their behalf, and they, those states also, have continuing representation in this assembly of states parties that is has some loose oversight supervisory functions relative to the court. It can decide to add or reduce crimes to the court's jurisdiction, change the definitions of crimes. So at least for states that are democratic, those populations are represented through their own states, first in consenting to the court and later in continuing to be represented through the assembly of states parties.
Bart Brown, I know you want to comment on that, but let me ask Madeline Morris one quick question. That is, can you give an example of an international institution that does function in that way, that doesn't suffer from a democratic deficit?
Well, there are so many different institutions, and they all have more or less remote representation of populations, but none of them, other than the ICC, would purport to exercise direct authority over an individual from a state that has not consented.
Okay.
The WTO is an example that itself comes under attack for a democratic deficit, but at least you either are, your state either is or is not a member of the WTO, and if it's not, the WTO would not presume to apply criminal sanctions.
I think we're mixing up apples and oranges here. Madeline points out rightly that the U.S. need not consent to the treaty. Of course the U.S. need not consent to the treaty, and it hasn't consented to the treaty, and it's not bound by the treaty. But that's a completely separate issue from whether individuals who committed international crimes are subject to prosecution. They always have been. They still are. U.S. military engages in an operation and there happens to be a war crime committed, the territorial state would have the right to prosecute the person involved right now. And
in their national court system.
In their national court system. And so, in fact, I think the U.S. would be better off having that person tried by an international criminal court than just being subject to the national jurisdiction of whatever state in which it operates. So I think this whole thing about the U.S. being bound and the democratic deficit, it confuses the U.S. as a government, which certainly need not accept a treaty, and the fact that that individuals are already subject to prosecution for crimes they commit on the territory of another state.
Gretchen, could I jump in here?
Sure, Ruth.
On that point, the claim is often indeed made that this doesn't affect our government as a third party, only our nationals as a third party. But I think there's a fundamental logical error in the argument, because in the same breath, the sincere and good faith adherents of the ICC treaty argue one need not worry about the court becoming too powerful because of an idea called complementarity, that national courts would be given the first bite at crimes that occur. But in the very examples we're talking about, where there are good faith differences in air doctrine, in artillery doctrine, by definition, we're not going to prosecute our own guys for doing something we've taught them to do and ordered them to do. So complementarity doesn't give us any confidence whatsoever that they wouldn't be prey to the ICC.
But what about what Bart Brown is suggesting, that if the U.S. were to conduct airstrikes, okay, let's say that someone in Afghanistan was upset with the way the U.S. had conducted airstrikes there, and I'm sure someone is, that they could bring U.S. officials or U.S. soldiers to court in Afghanistan already without an ICC?
Well, a couple of things. Number one is we have very little experience with that, because the grave breaches provisions of the Geneva Conventions of 1949 largely dealt with protected classes of persons. It's my massacre law, if you like. Don't rape women, don't shoot POWs in the back of the head. It wasn't battlefield operations law. Secondly, there's a difference between trying them in your own national court and in an international court. Third, the pretense of the ICC is that every country around the world that is a party to that treaty would have to arrest the GI if he's there on R&R, even if it was an unrelated country to the conflict. There's even an interesting New World Court case in which the Democratic Republic of the Congo, maybe not so democratic, but got annoyed that Belgium and its magistrate, Damien Vandermeersch, were purporting to indict the Congolese foreign minister. Congo went to the World Court and said, this is not permissible. And the court ruled that the Belgians had impermissibly tried to overcome the absolute immunity of a sitting foreign minister. And as well, Judge Guillaume, who was the president of the tribunal, said there are limits to how national
courts. We need to take a break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation as well as taking a few phone calls. So stay with us. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you are listening to Odyssey.
Thank you.
This is Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and on today's program, we've been talking about the International Criminal Court and some of the objections that the U.S. has raised to the court, objections which underlie its decision to withdraw from the treaty. We're talking with Madeline Morris, who teaches law at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. She joins us from Durham today. Joining us from New York City is Ruth Wedgwood, who teaches law at Yale and at Johns Hopkins. Ruth Wedgwood is also a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Here in Chicago, we're talking with Bartram Brown, who co-directs the program on international and comparative law at Chicago Kent College of Law. Let's take a phone call. Let's talk with Scott. Hello, Scott. You're on Odyssey.
Hi. During the beginning of the program, I heard your guest mention that any state that would have to be that other states might oppose this treaty, and they would still be subject to the will. But it only seems that only two states oppose it, and that's the United States and Israel. And I was wondering if anybody was willing to talk about the current conflict in the Middle East and American interests and how that plays into the whole thing.
I'd like to respond to that, to point out that there are currently 66 states that are parties to the treaty. So that means that roughly two-thirds of the states of the world are not parties to the treaty. 66 is about a third of the countries in the world. So with two-thirds of the countries in the world not having ratified this treaty and not having become parties to the treaty, I think we would be starting off on a very wrong set of premises if we were to think that there were only two states that oppose the treaty.
Are there
other powerful democracies? What we know is that there are only 66 states that support the treaty adequately to ratify.
Are there other powerful democracies that don't support the treaty?
There are. We'd have to go through the list. I don't have them immediately at hand.
India is one interesting example.
India?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
But most of our NATO allies, virtually all of them, I think, except Turkey, do support the treaty. And, of course, we're just talking about 66 ratifications at the moment. And, indeed, 120 countries voted for it at the Rome Conference. And I think the number of ratifications will eventually reach that level.
Okay, let's take another call. Our number is 1-888-859-1800. Let's talk with Bob. Hello, Bob. You're on Odyssey.
Hello.
Hello.
I was wondering if you think the United States is really worried about, like, the director of the CIA or maybe the Secretary of State going to court, like, say, illegally mining harbors or doing coup d'etats, or maybe large corporations such as banana companies that use all kinds of poisons on their crops and infect the water and kill and their health, you know, it. I don't know how to say it.
They'd be subject to this court?
Yes, because they'd be taken to court, and that's what they're really worried about. They don't really care about some soldier committing a crime.
Okay, Bart Brown, why don't you take that question?
Well, corporations will probably have little to fear. It's unlikely they'll be committing war crimes, crimes against humanity, or genocide. Sure, there's obviously the possibility that if you had a Saddam Hussein type person who's committing a direct act of aggression, that they could obviously somewhere down the line, when aggression actually comes under the jurisdiction of this thing, be prosecuted. And I think the U.S. government is concerned about some of these issues, and Ruth has rightly pointed out there's some issues about definitions of crimes and all of that. I think the problem is there is a lack of consensus on some of the rules, and the U.S. has worked hard to improve the consensus on that, had done that in the past, and should continue to do so. I think now that this ICC is going to be a reality, we have to find a way to work constructively with it. And that's really the best way to protect U.S. interest.
Ruth Wedgwood, it seems to me that Bob's question also implies that the U.S. might be concerned that this court would constrain its ability, its foreign policy ability, in less obvious ways, those parts of its foreign policy that are less obvious, and that the concern might not just be about soldiers who are clearly deployed on some mission overseas, but rather covert operations or other less well-known aspects of U.S. activity around the world. Do you think that is a legitimate concern?
I think they're both concerns. I mean, most commanders do take very seriously and sincerely their feeling of responsibility toward their youngsters, but at the higher levels as well. I mean, Henry Kissinger wrote a very passionate article critiquing universal jurisdiction and foreign affairs about a year ago. And he apparently has had some indications that magistrates in France or Spain or London might be troublesome to him, if only as a material witness. I think the concern is that there's both this growth of jurisdiction and a robust inclination toward reasoning by analogy. For example, even on corporations, I would not be surprised to find human rights groups arguing that if you invested in a conflict area, and in the course of that investment, since you're there by the permission of the host government, you had to in some ways cooperate with that government, and the government in turn was fighting a nasty civil war against an insurgent group, that those acts of cooperation might be taken to be vicarious liability for war crimes. The law there is currently contested, but there's often a view that international fora should, quote unquote, progressively develop the law. Inappropriate in criminal cases, in my view, but I wouldn't be surprised to see it happen.
Why do you think it's inappropriate?
Well, because the whole idea of criminal law is to have clarity in what the standards are so that you can conform to them and not be in hazard of criminal liability where you had no ability to know that what you did was forbidden. Sometimes lawyers call it the rule of lenity, of leanness, that in criminal law specifically, you expect a great deal of clarity. That's the whole reason in the Constitution that we have the ex post facto clause. You shouldn't be surprised after the fact that what you did was a crime when you had no way of knowing.
And these international crimes are not clear enough to be for jurisdiction to be extended in the ways that some people foresee.
Well, the words are clear. I mean, we think we know what genocide is. We think we know more or less what crimes against humanity are. But theories of responsibility, and I'll give you one example. In law of armed conflict, there's a vertical notion of vicarious responsibility where a commander has a duty to make sure his men or persons don't commit war crimes. And if he doesn't monitor them and doesn't punish them if they have run amok, he's responsible even though his own crime really is one of criminal negligence, not of commission. Some people would argue there should be a horizontal version of that command responsibility or a diagonal version where if you knew it was happening and had the ability to stop it, they might be inclined to infer a duty to stop it.
Let's take another call. Let's talk with Ahmad. Hello, Ahmad. You're on Odyssey.
How are you doing there, Gareth Gretchen?
Okay, but you know what? We've got a little bit of a problem. Ahmad, why don't you turn your radio down and we'll come back to you. Why don't we talk instead with Donald? Hello, Donald. You're on Odyssey.
Hello.
Hello.
I was wondering how you treat the various levels of these specific instances. Lieutenant Kelly and his officer Medina's treatment. Kelly got house. I was tried and got house arrest. Medina wasn't even tried at all. Second, Kissinger was overthrow of the Chilean government is well known and documented. The third level is the mining of Nicaraguan harbors, and the fourth level is a Cuba embargo. An embargo is an act of war, and we've had an embargo against Cuba for 40 years. How does the ICC approach each one of these problems? No, hang on. Thank you.
Okay. Bart Brown, do you want to begin to tackle those complicated questions?
Well, I mean, we take the Lieutenant Kelly example.
Lieutenant Kelly was the commander at My Lai.
Right. He was prosecuted by the U.S. government, and under if the ICC statute had been in effect and applicable, it would have ended there. He would have been prosecuted by the U.S. government, and there would have been no need for the ICC to become involved. There was a question about embargoes, I think.
Yeah, the Cuban embargo.
This is not just doesn't simply fall within the jurisdiction of the ICC. It doesn't. It won't impose embargoes. It will not deal with embargoes, which will not constitute war crimes, crimes against humanity, or genocide in any foreseeable scenario.
What about the examples of Kissinger or the mining of the harbors of Nicaragua?
Well, of course, as Ruth Wedgwood has just pointed out, Henry Kissinger is already facing some pressure from various national governments around the world. That's got not very much to do with the ICC. It's just a question of how those countries see the law applying, which I think folds into my point, which is that the law in this area is going to evolve, and we need to be involved in that. Because the law is not good enough, it does need to be perfected, and of course that's a constant struggle.
Ruth Wedgwood, may I come in?
Sure, Madeline Morris.
That brings us back to the question of the difference between what it means to say that a particular individual would be subject to prosecution in the state where they committed their crime and the very different proposition that they should be subject to prosecution in an international criminal court. As Professor Brown pointed out earlier, it's true that a particular individual who commits a crime or is alleged to have committed a crime on the territory of some state can be prosecuted by that state. That does not mean the same thing as to say, well, since they can be prosecuted somewhere, what the heck, we should also allow the ICC to have jurisdiction over them. And one of the, there are many, many differences, but one of them is this lawmaking function. As we've all been discussing, the law in this area is not entirely developed. There are gray areas. There are areas of controversy and disagreement about what the law is and should be. If you have the cases prosecuted and decisions made in the courts of various countries, then each of those various countries makes some contribution through the vehicle of their judicial decisions to the development of the law in this field. But if you have a case decided by the ICC, it will have vastly disproportionate impact on the law in that field.
All right, let's get back to Ahmad, who we left hanging. Ahmad, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, can you make your question quick?
Yeah, Gretchen, my question is of a historical nature. I was wondering, going back to the Nuremberg trials, why the United States, of all the participants, was selected to sort of supervise the trials in spite of the fact that it was not a neutral country in the conflict?
Who wants to tackle that one, Bart Brown?
I'll be happy to do that one.
Oh, Ruth Wedgwood?
To your taste. Well, the Nuremberg Tribunal was a joint military commission, if you like, of the victors in World War II, and the U.S. didn't dominate it. It was done jointly between the Brits, the French, the Americans, and the Russians. At times, there were some interesting tensions in the running of that tribunal, which may, I think, go to Madeline's point about politics, because at one point, the Russians wanted to charge the Germans with the massacre at Katyn Forest, the killing of the Polish officers, and of course, Stalin had done that. And it was only by a hair's breadth, I think, that the U.S. managed to keep the Russians from going ahead with what would have been an absolutely hokey charge. But if I could just also mention on the issue of past events, the court will not look backwards, only forward. But yet, one of its major areas of jurisdiction is so-called aggression, unquote, quote unquote. That means the use of going to war without proper authority. But in a moment when we think that you can't always go to the UN Security Council for a resolution, when the old-fashioned notion of self-defense in the face of armed attack is not perhaps broad enough to cover new examples of humanitarian intervention in Kosovo or even preemptive self-defense against weapons of mass destruction, it's a very, very poorly chosen moment to try to plug criminal law into such a dynamically changing area of a foreign policy, and where crucial supreme interests of safety and the state are at stake. You can't have a European law professor telling you what you're going to do in response to Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. The state is responsible. It's a moral responsibility, but it's too unclear, and the law is changing on what the ultimate standard of judgment should be.
Ruth Wedgwood teaches law at Yale University and Johns Hopkins University and joins us today from New York City. Madeline Morris, a quick final thought from you. Do you foresee a day when the U.S., when there will be a treaty that the U.S. will sign on to and will participate in?
It would be hard to predict that. I hope that that will be the case. I think it would be much better for international law in general and for the future of the court in its potentially constructive phase if we could modify the treaty in such a way that the U.S. could become an active participant. Whether and when this would happen would be far beyond my ken.
Madeline Morris researches and writes on international criminal justice issues. She teaches in the law school at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. She joined us from there today. Bart Brown, do you think we're headed towards a different treaty that the U.S. will join or a long period of...
Well, Gretchen, it's a long process and we're just at the beginning. I think the ICC is a very important, very small step forward for international justice. It's not going to have very much jurisdiction. It may never really hear any cases. Eventually, I think it will establish enough credibility that the U.S. will see that it has a greater interest in participating than in staying outside.
Bart Brown co-directs the program on international and comparative law at Chicago Kent College of Law. Bart Brown, Ruth Wedgwood, Madeline Morris, thank you all very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks also to everyone for listening and for calling. Odyssey's theme music was composed and performed by OK Go. We get help from many people, including our research assistant, Allison Rinnick, and our intern, Christopher Neary. Steve Waranowskis is our technical producer. Allison Cuddy is our associate producer. Joshua Andrews is the senior producer. The managing producer of Odyssey is Edward Lifson. Odyssey is a production of Chicago Public Radio under general manager Tori Malatia. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Join us again next time for Odyssey.
Odyssey is marketed and distributed by Marge Ostrushko. Funding for the program is provided by a generous grant from the listeners of WBEZ Chicago, where Odyssey is produced. To listen again, go to our website, chicagopublicradio.org/odyssey. You can find information there on how to order a copy of the show. That's chicagopublicradio.org/odyssey.